Accession number 8941, rule number 15.
Major Jefferson, reel 15.
Are we on? I was going to correct that last word. It wasn't like Hangman's Hill so much, because there was, in fact, a town on the top of this jagged rock. It was, as you yourself have said, much like the fortified villages in the south of France. If a reasonable size, small town with real fortifications, but it was stuck up a zigzag pass that not easy to get up even in a jeep, and it had a gate when you eventually got into it. Did I say on the last thing that I actually went back there? No, I didn't. Well, after the war, and a few years ago, I went back to it. Well, never mind. Yeah, yeah. So I think I probably didn't actually say that the Jebel Ghazi and Enfidaville, which De Kruna was the main feature, were in fact two battles, but very close together. And we had some nasty fighting there. I don't remember the details of it, but I do remember that indeed the 4th Indian Division book tells me that by now we were getting as many as 7 field and 3 medium regiments on targets at a time. But of course the equally true that the Germans were also doing rather the same thing, which made life not all that pleasant. Thank God they were a bit short of ammunition than we were.
So you don't remember the details, but you do remember a strong impression of it being intensive fighting.
Yes. In the gun positions, of course, it was more a question of being shelled. And I don't know how many casualties we had. Not heavy casualties, but I think we would have had heavy casualties if the battle had been fought as it was originally planned, because I think the counter battery would have been murderous. Equally, although I had frightening periods with the infantry, we didn't actually get involved in any charges at that particular thing. We were really planning the final battle at Enfidaville, and that would have been murderous. But thank God it was from there that we suddenly received orders to march out to the left and made the swing round to Medjez el-Bab. And I don't know if you were on the tape when you asked me, Takruna was one of the first inhabited places I saw, even though I saw it at a distance. But now we moved really into quite a cultivated country.
What was the actual Jebel like at Jebel Ghazi? Could you describe that?
Yes. Well, the German with the left-handed Jebel with the stick bomb was at the top of a fairly rounded hill. I think I ought to know the name of that hill, but I don't know that. Well, it would be the Jebel Ghazi, of course. And I was in the middle in a sort of funnel in my tank, and there was a bit of lower hill in front of me, and then away to the right the other hills, including eventually Enfidaville, going down to the coastal plain. But in front of me was a little, I imagine it must have been a pass, I never went through it, so I can't see, but there was a little smaller hill in between two valleys, with the big hill on the left with these Germans on.
And you didn't go into the little town of Tukrain at the time?
Takruna. Not at that time. No, I didn't see the little town until 1970 something. Well, I'm very grateful we didn't, because it wouldn't have been my idea of fun.
When you went back to look at it, were there any signs of war damage? place?
Not really, because I suppose there are bits of iron lying around, then what there always are in Arab villages. I suppose there were little pock marks in the stone walls, it was pretty solid stone, and the mud walls have been knocked down and rebuilt many times since those days, so no, the battle wasn't all that evident.
You mentioned the fighting at Enfidaville, and that if the initial plan had been put into effect, it would have resulted in very heavy casualties. Now, why was that? What were you going to have to do if the original plan was?
Well, someone was going to have to storm Dacruna for a start, or bypass it. Dacruna would have had to be taken, I think. We had in front of us. The further you go, the more concentrated the troops are against you. And we had in front of us the remains of the Africa Corps and some very good regiments. And the enemy had a fair number of guns and these naval werfers, these 88s. It would have been a murderous attack, and I think it was Gertie Tuker who was largely responsible for arguing that we do it the other way.
In other words, outflank it and bypass it.
Yep.
It sounds to me as though, as you moved out of the desert and into Tunisia, you were involved in a change of operational style, that in the desert the style of operations was rather loose and fluid. But once you got into Tunisia, it coagulated into much more regular and traditional European style of warfare, with positions being taken up and having to be formally assaulted by set-piece attacks. Is that a fair comment?
It's like so many comments, it contains a great deal of truth, but it would be possible to interpret it wrongly. In the desert, the original desert warfare was like naval warfare, and the last Battle of Alamein was a set piece just like the Somme. Yeah. So the desert, to me, contains both elements. But the part that one remembers most, because it took longest, is the fluid. Battles like Alam Halfa, but one mustn't forget that the last Battle of Alamein was a battle of the Somme, and people advancing against barbed wire and tanks and things, just like they did in the First World War. When we got to Marath also was very much like Alamein in that it was a defensive position prepared for a long, long time, and was flesh and blood against armour and barbed wire and metal. Then Wadi Akarit to us, Wadi Akarit to the 4th Indian Division was where we proved that we were a mountain warfare division. And it wasn't, we didn't move heavily, but we made a major impact on the battle because we were a mountain warfare division. And we were able, if the Gurks hadn't taken Fat Nasser when they did, there'd have been a lot more casualties down in the plain. Down in the plain, of course, 50 Div and 51st Div were fighting a more traditional battle already, but we were almost a bit like I imagine the North Frontier is. We were sending out pickets and both in the Martyr Hills and in Wadi Akarit. Then when we got to Enfidaville, the battle we were planning would have been a more traditional battle, but not quite as barbed wirey as Last Alamein. And when we got to Medjez al-Bab, then we did an assault with a two divisional barrage with, I think, 30 something lifts and with 20 or 30 targets nominated behind them. So there's a good deal of truth in what you're saying, but it's a very wide generalisation.
But once you got into Tunisia, did you ever have the same sort of fluidity that you'd sometimes had in the desert? Or had that gone completely? Self-contained forces roaming around.
We no longer had the jock columns and that sort of thing. Though the 4th Indian, or five brigades attacking them at Martyr Hills, had a great deal of jock column about it. But the major battle was a battle of commitment. From quite early on, from almost as soon as I knew 4th Indian Division, as gunners, we were always trying to concentrate ourselves. And in our training in Iraq, we'd been concentrating within the limits of the troops available. What did change, of course, was that in Tunisia I spent a great deal of time in tanks from Hunnis to Valentine's instead of in my own Tatanaga armoured car, which I still had, but I quite often was with tanks, although I may have been supporting infantry. I was with the tanks because they had very good communications in the tank WTOC sets. RTOC sets. I still see myself as supporting infantry, but most of the time I'm travelling in a tank, and there is a bit of a conflict in what I've just said. I can't at this range of time sort it out in my mind.
What happened at Medjez al-Bab?
Well, Medjez al-Bab, we got there, we marched through lovely, rich country to us, and we got there. It was in daylight, but I remember by now whether we were there 48 hours, 24 hours, or just went straight to the battle, I don't remember. But my first picture of Medjez al-Bab, in fact, is of me. Now in an enormous tank, whether it was a Churchill or a Cromwell, don't ask me, but it was a much bigger tank than I'd seen in the fighting so far. I was in that tank, not far behind the tanks that got blown up as they went over the crest. They are recorded in several histories, and I remember the big bang not all that far in front of me. But all it did was slow us down that night, and we got the next picture I have is of myself next morning, and now we have the 2/4 divisions, the 4th Indian on the right and the 4th British on the left, if I remember right, and the barrage has been fired over our heads, and I say it was probably 30 something steps, that barrage. And I'm in this tank, and I can see half a dozen little Gurkhas with their Kukris drawn, scurrying round the trenches and rabbiting out the Germans. The Germans didn't like the sight of the Gurkhas with their Kukris drawn. And I don't think any blood was shed, but indeed I don't think there was any very serious defence, and it was a two division up attack with an enormous barrage, and they knew they were beaten anyway. But I clearly see these Germans and the Gurkhas with their Kukris drawn.
You mentioned they were in trenches. Were these conventional?
I don't remember. In fact, I see them more as emerging from the side of a hillside, but I don't remember the detail. I just had this picture of the Gurks with their Kukris drawn. It's a sight one often thought of but didn't actually see very often as a gunner. And I had all these opportunities for fire. I don't know if I called on any of them or not. I don't think there was a great deal of fighting. There was just a barrage that we went under and we took the ground and moved on. And that was the end of the actual fighting. Although we moved from there, we reconcentrated as a regiment at a place, I think it was called Saint-Marie-du-Site. That was where the incident with the where the troops found the young wine, and where our hero Keelan got a black eye.
You were saying earlier that you were moving through fertile countryside.
Yeah.
Was it populated? Did you see anything of local?
I have a memory of passing the troglodytes, but whether that was on this particular trip, and I think it was, though it's also possible it was down in the Marath area, or it's also possible it was in both. But I remember looking down into a sort of quarry and seeing troglodytes. Homes. We didn't stop. I mean, we were on the march, and we got there, and we did the job, and we moved on. As I've said before, social life was there none until a few weeks after where we are now.
When you were following the tanks, you said they came over the crest, and there was a big bang, and they were blown up. What was it that blew them up?
I think it was on mines. I don't remember. It is fairly well documented. But I only have two or three snapshots in my mind of the chain of events. We were fairly tired by now, don't forget. And it's easy to make things up. But the snapshots I have are quite clear. And the gaps in between them are gone.
Do you remember what sort of formation the tanks were in for going in this advance?
I mean, when the bang occurred, we were on a road and going over the top of the Medjez al-Bab.
So the line ahead?
Yes, line ahead on a road. I mean, we weren't in action. We were moving up to the start line. And I think there were mines on the road, and I think one or two or three of these enormous tanks lost tracks and something, but didn't delay us for very long, and we just plowed on. When we were, my picture of the Gurkhas, all I can see are a few Gurkhas, but there must have been tanks in line with me, and maybe, no, I don't think there'd be any ahead of me. But I just remember the snapshot of the Gurkhas, it was a sight you don't forget.
So you went through Medjez el-Bab, and the regiment was then concentrated and didn't actually go forward into Tunis itself. At least you didn't.
I didn't, no. Because it was about here that I was called to Colonel Howell, who was the colonel by now, and told I had got the MC in the Mamata Hills, and that I'd be joining a small group of battle-scared officers to fly back to Cairo to train the troops for the invasion of Sicily. That was my first flight in an aeroplane from Benghazi somewhere. Not from Benghazi, from Tunis somewhere. I said Benghazi because there's another of my snapshots. I don't remember my first aeroplane flight at all, except it was a DC-3. But I do remember being on Benghazi airport on the way back. And I walked over the perimeter of the Aurora, around the wire. By airport, you mustn't think of things like Heathrow. And I walked round anyway from where our DC-3 was parked. And I came to the top of a sand dune. And as I came out of over the top of the sand dune, a sound hit me like 100 Paul Robesons. And that was a totally unforgettable experience. It must have been a West African, maybe East African, Labour battalion on the airport, and they were singing their songs, and it really was a quite unforgettable moment. And then we flew back to Cairo. I went then somewhere in the canal area. The troops that we were meant to be training, of course, were far better trained than we'd been for many years, because we'd been in battle, and they were extremely well trained. But they hadn't heard things go bang, and so we were told to go with them on their last exercises. And indeed, I went with them on board a ship. I forget the name of the ship. It was one of the Orient Line. In fact, it was a sister ship to the Ormond that had taken me out to India in 1941. And we captured Aqaba on this exercise. And when it was all over, they got into transport for Sicily. And we, of course, knew the phase of the moon and the type of sand and everything else that they were supposed to be doing. So although my regiment by now had marched down from Tunis to Alexandria, I wasn't allowed to join them. And I was confined to Shepherds for a fortnight.
When you were told you were going back to help train these troops, what impression did that all make on you? How did you feel about leaving the regiment or the battery and going back?
I have no memory of it. I don't think it was put as leaving the regiment or the battery. I think probably one saw the fact that with Robin Oswald from First Field, for instance, I think we all had our shy talks up. I think we knew. I don't think we even thought that we might not rejoin the 4th Indian Division or our regiment. I think we just thought, oh, lucky we're going to have first match at the flesh pots. I suppose much of anything. Although I don't remember it, the thought of flying must have been one of the first impressions I would have got.
You say these troops you had to help train on their final exercise were better trained than you had been. What do you mean by that?
I mean they were square bashers. In the nicest possible way, they'd been training for 3 years. We'd been fighting for 3 years. They, as far as training went, they were much, much better than we were. But that didn't necessarily mean that they would get under the skyline or not make noises at the wrong moment, that sort of thing.
Where had they been before? Had they been back in England?
I think they'd come from England. The gunners I was with, actually, were part... I think they must have been 110 Field, the second line of my original Manchester Artillery, because it was through one of the officers who introduced me to a Manchester girl that I actually met Dorothy a little later while I was confined to Shepherd.
And what form did this final exercise take, this assault on Aqaba?
We got in a boat and they transferred to smaller boats and went ashore. That's about as much as I remember now, but I mean, at the time we knew the whole plan. I don't think it was actually carried out that way at all, but we knew what the plan was meant to be.
You say smaller boats, were these purpose-built landing craft?
They were probably a few LSTs. There must have been. But I don't remember the detail of that at all. Except I have a picture again, one of these stills, of the boat Anakaba, which was only a couple of sheds in those days. And indeed it may have been Eilat in today's language. And we went ashore, and we went inland a bit. But there, that's gone. Other than the fact that it happened.
How were you received by these new boys who'd just come out? Were they eager to learn from you?
I think they were.
A veteran.
Well, I think all of us, our little squad, had something to show for the fact we'd been in action. They probably found us insufferable, but they didn't tell us so, and they certainly were keen to learn, because your life depend on it.
What did you do then when you were more or less confined to barracks in Cairo?
It was there that I actually met Dorothy, and as I say, introduced through a Manchester chap to a Manchester girl. The four of us went out to Mina House, and we had an excellent lunch at a table called Number Four, and we went halfway up a pyramid, and she squeezed my hand, and we came down, and the table was Number 44, and she said, "Four's my lucky number." And the next day we went out and had dinner at a table Number 444. So between the squeeze and the fours, I was exposed. And we eventually, 3 years later, got married in the Church of St. Michael All Angels Heliopolis.
What sort of conditions did you have in Shepherd's?
Oh, in great luxury. I mean, this is the first time I've been sort of in a room, proper room, for 3 years. And I remember... I think we had about £4 or £5 a day to spend. I think that's what my bank account out there ran to at that time, and that was enough in those days to do yourself fairly well and eat and drink and be merry.
No shortage of food or drink.
No, none at all. Well, shortage of drink. Yes, there was a shortage of drink, and that's interesting. If there's enough room on the thing, because there was usually one bottle of gin at 6 o'clock in Shepherd's, and one bottle of decent whiskey at the Continental at 6:30, and one bottle of something else at the place next door, some club, a quarter of an hour later. So there was a mantle to chase around, but of course that wasn't all that good, to drink one glass of gin followed by one glass of whiskey. Everywhere there was Bolinaki's brandy. And at that time, therefore, the sensible thing was, if you hadn't got your own or assured supplies, was to drink brandy and ginger ale. Because Molinaki's brandy was appalling brandy, but it was always the same.
So you'd go on horses' necks?
Well, I don't think we called it horses' necks in those days. But that was the accepted good form.